Okay. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. Today we're going to talk about the revised straw proposal for the Transmission Access Charge Options Initiative. My name is Christine Osborne. I work at the California ISO in the Stakeholder Process Group. What we're going to do before we go into the presentation is we're going to have the folks in the room introduce themselves so that all of you, excuse me, on the phone line know who's attending. So we have some microphones over here. Diane Broad, Oregon Department of Energy.
David Cohen, Navigant Consulting.
Haley Klein, Department of Justice, representing Commission staff.
Brad Mullins for the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities.
Carrie Simpson, Xcel Energy.
Tony Braun, Counsel of the California Municipal Utilities Association.
Denise Parrish, Wyoming Office of Consumer Advocate.
Dennis Holcomb, Sacramento Municipal Utility District.
Alexandra Mackey, Pacific Gas and Electric.
Eric Menzel, Pacific Gas and Electric.
Lynette Kozlowski, PG&E.
Alyssa Koo, PG&E.
Todd Deinhart, Pacific Corp.
Eric Arzola, Pacific Corp.
Caitlin Leoteris, Energy Strategy.
Brian Bradshaw, Schlein.
Aaron Kester, Avangrid Renewables.
Andrew Medet, SMUD.
Henry Tillman for NIPSI.
Cameron Yurkowski, Renewable Northwest.
Virginia Thompson, California ISO.
Keone Almeida, California ISO.
Mike McClenahan, Grant PUD.
Sorry, I'm out of breath. That was a journey. In my high heels. Margaret Miller with Customized Energy Solutions.
Okay, is that everybody in the audience? Jody Cross, ISO. Over here? Oh, we have a microphone in the front here, so if you could pass that.
Derek Plager, Bonneville Power.
Chris Lockman, Bonneville Power.
Jason Weinstein, Bonneville Power.
Rebecca Pettinger, Bonneville.
Josh Walter, Seattle City Light.
Eric Kim, California ISO.
Paul Nelson, Southern California Edison.
Marshall Dempsey with UAMPS.
Dax Gray with UAMPS.
David Smith with Transwest Express.
Cam Strack, San Diego Gas and Electric.
Tim Haynes with the California State Water Contractors.
Johnny Useldinger, Portland General Electric.
Lorenzo Christoph, California ISO.
John Anders, California ISO.
Hey, did we get everybody? Everybody introduce themselves? So, Colin, if you could just kind of give us a count of how many people are on the web, not list the names, but if you could just tell us the numbers of folks that are on the web.
It looks like we have about 63 on at the moment.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, well, good morning. So this is the agenda for today. It's Lorenzo Christoph is our primary presenter. We do have some other ISO representatives here who will help support him in questions. So he's going to review the revised straw proposal. We are going to take a lunch break from 12 to 1. There are some restaurants nearby. I'm not sure where there are, but I'm kind of counting on the PAC people and BPA, and we have some ISO folks that are familiar with this area as well. So we'll kind of guide you on where you can go to lunch. After we come back from lunch, Lorenzo will continue the discussion on the proposal, and then we are going to open up for questions and some good dialogue in the afternoon, and then we'll talk about the next steps for for this initiative. So this is the timeline for regional integration activities. We did conduct meetings last week on SB 350 studies. We did publish the preliminary results for those studies. And we had some good discussion last week. We did record those meetings, so if you didn't have a chance to participate, those recordings are on the Regional Energy Markets webpage, so you can listen into those. There's also the presentation materials as well. The next steps for that is that we will be publishing the final results sometime at the end of this month, but we will announce that in a market notice, so stay tuned for that. We did have a regional governance meeting on May 6th that was hosted by the CEC. There is going to be another meeting coming up at the end of the month, also hosted by the CEC, and look for a market notice coming out at the end of the week on that. The policy stakeholder initiatives, the transmission access charge options is one of those initiatives. We also have the active initiatives right now are the metering rules enhancements, also the regional resource adequacy. We're going to have a meeting here tomorrow to talk about the second revised draw proposal, so hopefully you'll be able to join us for that. We have a couple of other initiatives that are going to be starting this year. There's the greenhouse gas compliance initiative and the full network model enhancements initiative. So we will announce when activities start on those, we will announce those through a market notice. And then the plan is for PacifiCorp to start their state regulatory proceedings in 2017. So we did publish an issue paper and a straw proposal, and we also published the revised straw proposal, which we are going to discuss today. We did gather your input on all of the proposals, which we really appreciate, so thank you for that. So after the meeting today, we are going to ask for you to provide written comments. So the comments that you make today or questions that you have, we do encourage you to provide those in your written comments. Those will be due by close of business on June 10th. We plan to publish a draft final proposal around June 28th, followed by another stakeholder meeting to discuss the draft final proposal. And the goal is to take it to our ISO Board of Governors at the August meeting. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn over to Lemons and Kristoff. The materials that we're going to be reviewing today, as well as the revised draft proposal, are on the initiative webpage on the ISO website. If you go to the Stay Informed tab and select Stakeholder Processes, you'll see all of the of ISO's active initiatives linked there. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lorenzo. Go ahead, Denise. We do have a question. Yes. By the way, we don't have mics at all the tables. They are in the aisle ways here, so you get some exercise today.
So just a quick question on the initiatives. Is there still no plan for a grid management charge initiative yet?
We haven't sort of publicly announced a plan or a date for that, but it is still being contemplated. So, to the extent that you know, PacifiCorp is needing to conduct its net benefits study, and those costs influence that, that would then give it similar stature to these other initiatives, the TAC and RA. But the timing and scope of that is still under consideration.
Hi, this is Dave Smith. I had a process question. There was a fair amount of comments submitted by the commenters on the former proposal. I wondered, did you guys go through and identify specific responses to each of those? I saw some responses in your proposal today, but I don't know what the status is of all the other comments that were made, and whether you know you're expecting us to repeat that comment or you know what the process is. Because in a lot of other ISO processes, we get the response back on comment by comment basis.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question, and you know, I apologize. We have not gone through and done like a complete stakeholder. Part of the reason is that not repeat stuff you said in those previous comments. You don't really need to say the same. But if there are things that are still relevant, I would leave it up to you to summarize all of what we've received insofar as it's relevant to where we ended up with the
And Christina, sorry to interrupt, but Slim, you know, the current speaker is very hard to hear. The mic is breaking up for those on the phone.
Okay, thank you, Colin. We're going to try to get another microphone for Lorenzo. Hold on a second, please. Thanks for being
Thank you. Okay, so hopefully this sounds better. Let me know on the phone if it's not, and I will try to keep close enough to it so that everybody hears well. The main point that I was making was basically that for additional comments that come in after this meeting, it would be sufficient, and we'd request that you focus on what is new about this proposal, either decisions that new material that's here that hasn't been in a previous proposal. If there are things that you said earlier, don't feel a need to repeat those things. Apologize, we haven't done a complete. When we get in the next phase of this, we'll do a more complete stakeholder matrix with all comments and responses to them. Okay, so where we are today, revised straw proposal. Uh-oh, it went blank. Okay, so are people, is there like a webcast that people are seeing with this? So as you know, sort of the background bears repeating, transmission access charge is a mechanism that we use in order to collect transmission revenue requirements for the transmission-owning utilities that become members of the ISO as participating transmission owners. Own those assets, they have to be, they're responsible for assets, and all of those costs become FERC-approved transmission revenue requirements, which then the ISO collects, at least for the high voltage piece, which is above 200 kV. We collect through our market settlement process and remit that money to the PTOs. So the idea being a transmission-owning utility transfers operational control to the ISO. That is, we do all the scheduling. We do the balancing of the system, perform all the But the PTO is responsible for maintenance and operation, and that's it. So that's what TAC is. It's a mechanism. We have a certain structure that's in place today for our existing balancing authority area footprint, and most recently that was approved by FERC when we did our Order 1000 compliance a few years ago. We have some of the new terminology and consistent with the provisions of Order 1000, essentially the same procedure that we were using before then, but we had to demonstrate why it could requirements of Order 1000, which FERC approved, and essentially the structure consists of what's called a postage stamp regional rate, where the ISO's total balancing authority area is considered a region technology. And the regional rate was for recovery of transmission revenue requirements associated with all of 200 kV. And that dollar amount collectively for all the PTOs gets turned into a dollar per megawatt hour charge based on a forecast of megawatt hours of internal load and exports from the ISO. So that numerator, denominator gives you a rate, and we tack that on to the settlement charges for exports and internal metered demand. Then there are PTO-specific local rates to recover TRR for facilities rated below 200 that are under ISO operational control. And depending on which of the major utility service territories it is, there are different amounts of that lower voltage transmission under ISO operational control. So different rates for each area, and those are also recovered through charges to load, although I believe that's done directly through the utilities. Currently, then, the only structure really is this 200 kV dividing line, a threshold based on voltage level. We don't differentiate cost allocation based on project type, whether it's reliability, economic, or policy-driven project, or on in-service date or any other non-voltage level factors. Part of the rationale for that, which we argued when we filed our compliance with Order 1000, was that given the ISO's existing footprint and the arrangements that were agreed to by the parties when the ISO formed and as evolved to this regional rate over a 10-year period, that the 200 kV threshold was a just and reasonable proxy for whether the benefits of the facilities would be enjoyed at the level of the entire ISO region or more locally. So the question then, when we contemplate a much larger balancing authority area that would be formed if PacifiCorp becomes a first new major PTO in the ISO, is whether that same structure is appropriate or not. Having gone through an issue paper last fall and several public meetings and comments and then a straw proposal earlier, we've come to the conclusion that it does need to be changed, that we need a different approach as we move into a larger geographic area with multiple states, with a lot of different bases on which transmission were determined to be needed and built. And so what we are focusing on in this initiative is very specifically the high voltage component, that is facilities above 200 kV. How would we recover those costs in a much larger balancing authority area? Underneath that is the assumption that we would still retain the PTO-specific structure for facilities that are below 200 kV as it is today. In addition, the situation that we're contemplating is really focused on general principles that would apply anytime we add a significant large new PTO with a transmission service territory. I'll get to that in more detail in a moment. But just a fact to be aware of is that the ISO has some participating transmission owners that don't have any load service territory because our transmission process allows for competitive solicitation to build and own certain facilities that are approved in the transmission planning process. We have entities that have built transmission under that competitive solicitation. They continue to own and maintain and operate the physical assets, and so they are participating transmission owners in the field, but they don't have a load service obligation and they don't have customers in particular. So really the conversation we're having here is about what happens when you add a new significant group customers, end-use customers, who would be paying for the transmission system through the access charge. And then finally, we've assumed for purposes of this initiative to really keep the focus on the regional cost allocation aspects. That is, how do you take high voltage above 200 kV and allocate service territory? We have put aside the idea of some completely different structure of TAC other than a volumetric per megawatt hour rate. That's the formulation that we've used since the ISO started up, and for purposes of this initiative, we are assuming that that will continue. So where do we go from here? This is getting into more of the specifics of the proposal. Some of this is consistent with the previous proposal, some of it's new. FERC Order 1000 terminology, in accordance with that, the current ISO footprint is a region, but once we have an expanded balancing authority area, then that expanded area will become the region. Again, FERC Order 1000 terminology. So FERC defines region and local, and local being the PTO-specific facilities. So the region is now the bigger balancing authority area, and for purposes of transmission cost allocation, we believe it's useful to define something that we call subregions, which is intermediate between the entire region and the local individual PTO, and define that subregion in such a way that the current ISO balancing authority area, our current footprint, would be one subregion, and each PTO with a load service territory of significant size, I'll get to that in a moment, that joins the expanded BAA would also become a new subregion. So Pacific Corps, if it joined a separate subregion. Now, we had a lot of comments on this. I had just put out basically bullet 3 in the previous proposal. Many comments came in asking questions about, well, what about these exceptional cases? We have smaller PTOs that may be embedded inside an existing PTO region. Larger territory, or some that may be so adjacent to that they're electrically very integrated with and relatively small. Do we want to create a new subregion for every one of those smaller entities? And we felt that it made sense to allow for exceptions where we have cases of smaller entities that may be either completely inside an existing subregion, or in some cases adjacent to and very electrically interdependent with or connected with. I haven't got an engineering definition of that yet, so take this as a concept that we would spell out in more engineering detail. But with that idea, then there would be a different treatment of those smaller entities that we would allow for. In particular, to give that smaller entity a one-time choice as to whether it wanted to be its own subregion or whether integrated with the subregion to which it is already electrically closely connected or already embedded. Now, this would not mean that it could choose arbitrarily to join any subregion it wanted. The basis for being able to make that choice is the fact that there is an electrical reason why it's either internal to electrically closely interconnected with the region that it might join. So you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, if it's okay to ask questions.
Sure, please do.
This is Eric Menzel, PG&E. Regarding your last bullet there and the joining of a smaller PTO that might be embedded within a larger one, you said earlier it made sense to the ISO to allow them to have a choice when they joined, whether they want to become their own. If you could expand on that, please, why that makes sense, not just on electrically, on electrical basis, but also on a revenue basis.
Sure.
And if I can have a follow-up question after that, that'd be great.
Okay, sure. Well, there would be a financial, there could be financial impacts one way or the other. If a small entity decides to become part of the subregion, then whatever we're proposing for subregional cost allocation, they would automatically be included in that. If they choose to become part of that subregion, then they simply share whatever cost allocation goes to the subregion. If they choose to be separate, then not only are they not part of that subregion cost allocation, but anything that is an enhancement to their system in the future is something that they're going to be entirely responsible to. That doesn't qualify for regional cost allocation, that is, cost allocation across multiple regions. So we felt that it would be fair to allow a choice at one point as to that individual entities' expectations of sharing in these larger costs or bearing all costs of future local.
Choice would just be that entity's choice. It wouldn't be the existing PTO that they're embedded in. Meaning they make the choice. It's not.
Well, that's a good question. And I actually did get a question from someone on that same point over email as to whether the existing PTO that had the subregion in which it was embedded or adjacent to would also have a choice. And frankly, we hadn't thought about that in offering this question, whether it's something that the two entities need to agree on, and if so, what would be the default if they don't agree? That's another level of complication. I don't want to exclude that, though, so I think that's a reasonable.
Well, the curiosity on my part is if you take an embedded subregion, embedded PTO, and today they would be paying wheeling for all the transactions, meaning they pay to wheel out surrounding transmission area,
mm-hmm.
That wheeling charge, if they elect to become their own subregion, would go away, and they would still just pay their existing. And transmission projects, if they join or don't join, would still be dependent on some sort of regional planning process. Cost allocation would still depend on the regional planning process. So I'm not sure that they are confronted with great risks if they become their own subregion and they already have an existing, quote-unquote, TAC charge that's lower than the surrounding region, meaning they strictly benefit by avoiding wheeling costs that they pay today when they become their own subregion. They avoid them. And
well, I don't think that's correct, actually. Let's imagine a small entity inside the current ISO that's separate. They're paying a wheeling charge if they're exporting from the current ISO. Now, if they become inside the ISO, they're still paying the TAC on all of their megawatt hours of internal load.
If they are their own subregion, they pay it based on their own internal TAC, don't they?
Based on their subregional rate.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is what they're paying today, anyways. I mean, an internal muni or something like that has their own transmission cost that they're paying, so
mm-hmm.
that doesn't change. But if they become their own subregion, they avoid, you addressed earlier, the wheeling
okay.
cost, and they don't only avoid it at the TAC rate, the high voltage level. How the low voltage rate will be addressed too, because there are internal embedded munis, PTOs, load serving entities that pay both high and low voltage wheeling, and would
yeah.
they also then drop the low voltage wheeling?
Yeah, so if they are taking service, say, off of the low voltage system, right, inside an existing PTO.
Correct, and now,
yeah.
now they are their own subregion.
Yeah, I would imagine that. Not avoid that, but let me see what John wants to add on to this.
So, Eric, these are all very very good points. I think we came up with this principle for discussion, and I do believe, and we've observed at least anecdotally in conversations and looking at various systems that the risk, as you stated it, I think there is some risk. In other words, on a long-term going forward basis, so this is a one-time election, they would be assuming the risk of costs internal to their subregion for all transmission facilities that weren't regional. In other words, there may be lower voltage reliability upgrades or higher voltage projects necessary, to meet other criteria in their area, and those costs would be paid for entirely within their subregion. Now, some of these smaller regions may be large enough where that is less of an issue, but there may be others who are quite small have very limited transmission assets, very small amounts of load on which to spread the costs. And so those were kind of the distinctions we were trying to draw. So if a utility has 100, 200, 500 megawatts of load, and they incur a $50 million upgrade on their low-voltage transmission system, it's a much smaller rate base on which to recover those costs, so they would absorb all of those costs.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is situation today is if they have to build that $50 million project, they incur those costs internally and pass them on through their load internally regardless. And today, for any energy that they're trying to acquire that has to use the external transmission system, they are paying wheeling. And if they elect to join the ISO, they will, and become their own subregion, they avoid the wheeling costs, both low and high voltage, but they don't, are differently situated for their internal costs. If there is a regional benefit to their internal project, it's going to have, A, has to go through the planning process, so if there's a regional benefit, they have an opportunity to pass some of those costs along regardless. So their advantage between what they are in the manner they're situated today, where they're carrying 100% of those costs, and if they are sub-regionally situated or part of the larger sub-region, there's no they might be able to pass on more of those costs, again, depending on the ISO transmission planning process and the cost allocation process. So I just see the proposal that the ISO is putting forward regarding embedded PTOs being able to join and elect whether they want to become their own subregion or not very beneficial and a big door opener to PTOs that have not yet joined, but there is no current benefit to the existing PTOs. They simply lose wheeling revenue. I don't see a balance in that. And if you can expand on it, made sense for the existing PTOs to be able to give that choice to the new PTOs, that would be helpful. And if there's no benefit, that's fine too.
So just to the question about why we added this additional detail, remember the original straw proposal simply provided that each new PTO would automatically become its subregion. So we were attempting in part to mitigate potential harm to smaller PTOs, transmission owners, municipal utilities, by having to become their own subregion. And you're saying that you don't perceive any risk or downside to them whatsoever for maintaining their own subregion. So we thought it was appropriate because we perceived that there may be some risk to them by having to be required, in essence, to maintain their own subregional status. So we wanted to give them a one-time option to decide to join the larger subregion or stay their own subregion. So that it was additional optionality, if you will, from where the straw proposal was.
Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. I kind of share the same concerns that Eric had brought up, but it also, the other issue you have is this choice is, you know, perhaps they have very high expensive transmission costs, and so by joining that subregion, then they can socialize them across a bigger footprint as an also area. What I see here in how subregions are created, there seems to be a lack of principles of how that comes about. You know, because if they have given the choice, they're going to pick what's in their financial best interest. And that may result in unfair consequences to the subregion they intend to join or not join if they have that option, in the case of the wheeling revenue. So there seems to be, what I see is sort of a lack of principles on this, and I think I'll probably have some more discussion and maybe get into sort of, you know, what's new, existing, what's subject to competition, because we're setting up this thing where the CAISO has multiple PTOs in it, and then you could have the rest of this expanded footprint where each subregion is one PTO, and it seems to me there's also some issues with what's subject to competition, what's not. In this new construct, it seems like to be PTOs may be dealt with differently depending on whether they're commingled with others in a subregion or their a PTO is their own subregion. And I'll probably talk about that more later on that topic when we move into that area.
Okay, well, let me just, thanks, Paul. Let me just to follow up on that. I mean, you brought a whole lot of issues together in one little paragraph, which is fine because everything's connected, right? But it seems like there are a few choices here. I mean, where we started out was simply every new PTO becomes a that, I think a number of people said that didn't make sense, and that sort of seems like maybe it doesn't make sense in every case. And then the question is, well, define cases where it doesn't make sense and we should do something different, and then what do? We could automatically say it's going to be included within the subregion that it's electrically embedded, or we could say there's some optionality allowed either for the new entity joining or for the existing region that it would become a part of, or both, in which case we still need a default rule for what happens if they don't agree. So I'm just sort of enumerating the different ways that we might handle this situation short of having every new PTO always become a subregion.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely not easy because there's this sort of there's issues on each side of the balance that you're trying to weigh. I mean, because, you know, and it's not easy to get it right because, you know, in this environment where you're commingling costs, there's going to be cost shifting. That's just, you know, we have that today within the construct of CAISO. There's cost shifts between the PTOs. Mm-hmm. And moving forward is, you know, getting that balance right where you don't set up rules that become a tool for what might be considered unreasonable cost shifting.
Yeah. So I think, you know, what that suggests to me in a subsequent iteration is to really sketch out the different ways that this could be handled and what might be
right.
The pros and cons of them.
And that's what kind of, you know, to me, when I kind of develop proposals, I start with a set of principles that help me guide, you know, the details.
So what would be a principle here that comes to mind?
I think, you know, No unreasonable cost shifting. Of course, even defining what's considered unreasonable is a difficult task in itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been trying to do some things to that. Maybe I'll try to add some more detail and comments.
Yeah, and I don't have a good answer to that either.
I mean,
on the spot, you opened your mouth, though, so you're up there. But it's true. We all have to grapple with that. And anyway, it's that alignment of costs with benefits. How do you get it close enough to be...
Right.
Reasonable. So.
Right.
Okay. Anyway.
Okay. Thank
but
you.
Thank you. I'll let you sit down. Lynette, were you going to say something? You'll say. Okay. Sure.
Hi, Dave Smith with Transwest Express. I don't mean to get ahead of the agenda here, but I know that on cost allocation matters, you're proposing that a state regulatory group would. Cost allocation methods. Would that apply to this issue as well, or have you thought through that, or when you're thinking about principles and other things?
We'll make a note of that and come back to it. I think maybe is the best I could say at the moment.
Okay, Colin, let's check to see if anybody on the phone has a question. If you do have a question, you can enter the queue by pressing #2 on your telephone. And just a reminder to please identify yourself first. Looks like we have a question. Go ahead and open up the line, Colin.
Hi, this is Liam Noy from Xcel Energy. I was listening to the conversation, and it was mentioned that a subregion might be allocated the cost for both the local or the smaller, lower voltage projects, but also in some circumstances could be allocated the cost for the high voltage projects as well. And I was wondering what makes the distinction between, you know, say a project is over 200 kV and planned as part of the planning process in California. What makes it the distinction between if it is added to the the full regional TAC or if it is allocated directly to the subregion.
John, I think if I understood the question, so the distinction would be the same. So if it was, it could be above 200 kV, so a high voltage project that's eligible potentially for regional cost allocation, but not meet any one of the threshold criterias for cost allocation on a regional basis. Therefore, that project would be paid for 100% by that sub-region.
Let me interrupt. Were you asking about the current ISO practice and rules, or are you asking about the potential future? I think I misunderstood the question.
I think the potential future, but it sounds like maybe the same. And apologize, I'm not very well-versed in the process. You said that there's eligibility criteria that it might not meet. What are those? Are they?
Well, yeah, we're going to get to that. I mean, that,
okay.
Right now we're just sort of defining the subregion concept, and what all it means and how it plays out will be something that we'll get to in the next several slides, if you don't mind.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
All right, so to continue. Okay, that's the next slide. Okay, so we're moving on to what's slide 12 in this deck, definition of existing facilities. Now, the question of new versus existing was something we had a lot of discussion about in the past meetings, and what we try to do here is put a little bit more consistency on what is boundary between new and existing facilities. Conceptually, are transmission assets in service or planned in the entity's own planning process for its own service area. So those existing TPP process for how it decides to build transmission upgrades, and have either begun construction or have committed funding. So that additional clause at the end of that first bullet is offered to give more precision to that boundary between when does a project, when has it proceeded far enough that we'd say it needs to be existing. Under our definition structure. So begun construction has some precedent that we thought would be useful here from the IRS rules that were put in place and recently clarified, the footnotes in the paper, for renewable energy projects that are seeking to get investment. The IRS stated that it needs to have begun construction by a certain date. And they defined what begun construction means in terms of physical work of a significant nature. It's not in the slides here, but I think their criterion was like 5% of the cost, or that they've spent money equivalent to 5% of the budget of the project. And spent money could be committed to purchase materials, supplies, or actually activity, physical activity in construction of the project. So, and there's a whole IRS memorandum on that, which, you know, even though it was written for renewable energy projects, the whole notion of having begun construction on something seems like it could be usefully context. So that's why we put that in there. And the other, if it didn't begin construction, but it has committed funding, that ought to be something that appears in the financial corporate entity that's responsible for building it. And either that would appear in publicly available financial disclosure accounts publicly traded company, or would be provided to the ISO by affidavit of the appropriate executive responsible for making that budgetary decision. So,
this is Alyssa Koo from PG&E. I have a question about this. Your definition of begun construction seems to assume that the entity would want it to be an existing facility, and these are the requirements it has to satisfy in order to get. What if it's the reverse? What if the entity doesn't want it to be considered an existing facility? Maybe they haven't done any physical work, but they have spent, you know, over 5% of their budget, but that's not disclosed on any publicly available documents. Do they have to come forward somehow with an affidavit and say, yeah, we spent this, and I guess we're existing? They just kind of say, hey, it's not publicly available, and so we're not existing. I mean, how would you know one way or the other?
Well, in other instances, we use ISO affidavits to the ISO to establish certain facts, and there's a penalty of perjury for lying to the ISO if that could be disclosed or uncovered somehow. And I guess what you're suggesting is if they don't want us to know that, we might never know it. John?
Yeah, Alyssa, that's a good point. I think that you're correct. These regulations were drafted for somebody that's motivated to qualify for an investment tax credit. But maybe the affidavit could be structured in such a way that it said they affirmatively have to say, have they or have they not committed, and then that way they are attesting. And if somehow it's discovered through a process later on, then that project may be disqualified from regional.
Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. The Big Cane construction puzzles me on this one because you're going to commit funding before you start any construction. I mean, the planning process, the permitting process costs money. So when I read this, the committing funding is the key point because that's what's going to happen before you do construction. So I'm a bit puzzled why the begin construction is in there. And again, what is committing funding? Is it planning? Is it does that not count? Does it have to be FAA permitting? Or does that not consider committed funding? And so there's a little bit of vagueness on where that is.
Well, I think the idea is that it's some percentage of what is the anticipated total cost of the project, and it has to exceed that threshold. At least that's, I think, how the IRS applies this. And I seem to recall 5% of the total cost of the project should be spent, or okay. I think it could be incurred through contractual agreements to procure stuff.
Oh, okay.
So it would be a percentage of the total project cost.
Okay. Thank you.
Henry Tillman with NIPSE. And I think my concerns are similar to the two previous speakers. You know, when I was reading the struck me that, you know, you have a definition for new regional facilities, definition for existing facilities, but it seems like there's a gap that I could wind my way through in between. It seems like the key to the new regional facilities is going through this. It should just be everything else. Setting up a definition that, you know, talks about beginning construction or committing funding, okay, you have that definition, but what if it doesn't qualify under the definition of existing facility? It also doesn't it hasn't gone through the planning process. It seems like there's a gap in the middle. And written comments, I have to go through the process internally, but I suspect the written comments will suggest define new regional facilities and then requirements to be a new regional facility.
Well, let me go back to where you started. I think that's a very good point, and that's what we want to do here is that we want to define new facilities as anything that's planned through the larger integrated planning process. Everything else is existing. But the question that has come up in the last round of discussion here is So suppose an entity has done a bunch of work to advance a project and then brings it into process for consideration in that process. Are there any limits to say, no, you can't propose that now in this new integrated planning process because it's existing. You've already done something. You've already work on that project. It's passed certain milestones. And I think that was sort of what this is trying to sort of guard against.
And that, and if that's the case, I think I would hope that the regional planning process or the new planning process have a mechanism to deal with that. I mean, maybe it's appropriate for that body to consider that project. Maybe it isn't. But at this point, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, who is going to determine whether there have been sufficient funds committed to preclude that project from being considered by the probably the body itself? I just think that it would be a lot cleaner to have an either or and trust the regulatory body to make the right decision. But the concern I have is that you carve out a definition, you carve out one bubble, and you carve out another bubble, and there may not completely intersect. There may be a third bubble in the middle that isn't. I mean, it's only defined by the fact that it doesn't meet the definition of the other two.
Well, again, we're trying to do what you say,
yeah.
Is have only two bubbles,
right.
Okay, and have one bubble that's well-defined, and that's the new, and then everything else is in the existing. But that still doesn't define the boundary clearly enough. That's kind of the problem I'm getting to here.
Right.
The bound, because when would you say an existing project, it was planned in another... has approved it, but how far can it go before they say, well, we really want to consider it in the new larger regional plan? When can you say, no, sorry, you've already progressed so far that's got to be considered existing?
The reality is projects get abandoned all the time, and those become, there could be a decision, well, I'm not going to continue funding this project. What happens then to that project if that project is then submitted into the plan?
Okay.
Thanks.
Just a reminder to the audience, if you could speak kind of close to the microphone so that people on the phone can hear. Thank you. You can take it off the stand if you need to. There you go.
Hi, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. And just picking up on that point that was just made between, one definition of projects and another definition of projects, the ISO and other regional planning groups this year has started an interregional project coordination review. And so I would think that projects that are being reviewed under that would be the ones that would be eligible to kind of go from a regional planning process over to an expanded regional process. If you look at, there's a number of interregional projects. Transwest is one of them. SWIP North is another. Gateway potentially is another one. All three of those projects have been reviewed by NTTG in the last two-year planning cycle. So I don't know where that fits on that year chart there. And now they're all being considered possibly for funding from the CalISO TAC. And so... this is a planning process that's going to go on for the next 2 years. If these projects get put up into that process and identified, then it's also in the regional process and also interregional, which is kind of heading towards possibly an expanded region. I'm not saying all those definitions fit up the same, but when you're looking at expansion of large capacity with billion-dollar projects, all this cost allocation doesn't matter as much as do we need physical capacity to meet your needs, to meet NTTG's needs? All that planning can be done, and then the result of that can be brought forward to whatever group might potentially fund those projects. So I think, your list there reminds me of TEPSI had a thing about assumed projects versus non-assumed projects, and this was just to get into a base case. And there was all kinds of discussion about what's that commitment mean to get in there. And that was just fraught with all kinds of ways. If you're in an IRP, you're assumed into the project, and you know what's it mean to be in an IRP and stuff. You had an existing fund or some commitment to funding. One question I'd ask is that commitment to funded something that has to be approved by a regulator? Is that what the commitment means, or exactly where are you going to draw all that line? But I think the interregional planning process provides a bridge for the types of projects in between, that might be considered in the future for an expanded grid versus what might be looked at as interregional projects now.
Dave, are you suggesting that then participation in the interregional process might be a filter if you want a project in order to be considered for interregional cost allocation somehow? Is that like a requirement? It needs to have gone there first in this intermediate period before we have the expanded transmission planning process? Because that's really the boundary I think we're all talking about, right? What do you do with things like Gateway at Transwest that are in that process now? When do they count as existing versus when do they count as new?
Yeah, and I guess I'm not thinking of it as much like that. I'm thinking this expansion of the ISO could or could not happen, right? That's not a given.
Right.
You're all working towards it.
Exactly.
You know, we're all trying hard. We're supportive of it. But it may not happen for a variety of reasons. You still need to probably consider these interregional projects to meet your needs or not. Mm-hmm. And if people want to have a project that you would consider to meet those needs, because you're identifying all kinds of benefits of accessing either New Mexico or Wyoming wind. And so if you're in that review, then it seems like you're likely to be possibly in the expanded review. So I'm not sure it's I guess I don't think of it as a filter as much, but I think of a project that's in, the Gateway projects have been reviewed for three cycles in the NTTG plan. Mm-hmm. One could say that I don't know if it's existing, approved, or what it is, but it's not like it's a brand new project for the ISO to now consider.
Right.
And I don't say that anything bad about Gateway. I mean, Transwest is in the same case. We've been asking to be reviewed for a number of years and looking forward to having that review done. So I guess I'm not thinking about it, whether it's a filter for, in the end, people have to pay for it or not pay for it. So I think that whatever you decide about existing versus future, I mean, there's going to be a lot of discussion about it. But you do have a planning process now that it can start to be looked at.
Right.
As opposed not looking at it until this is all decided and then thinking about how to allocate out the costs.
Mm-hmm.
Or how to create a framework to allocate the
right.
costs is what we're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Your question on the phone?
Sorry, folks. It looks like I've lost connection, so that's why you're not seeing the slides. But based on the conversation that we've been having, are there any questions? If you have a question, you can press pound 2 on your telephone. I am trying to reconnect to get the slides back up. Work off paper for now while I get reconnected, Lorenzo.
Oh. We can't project on the screen either.
No, it has to be from the computer. So sorry, folks. Sorry for the inconvenience. I'll try to get reconnected.
Okay. And Christina, in the meantime, looks like we do have one written question that just came through.
Okay.
It says, in Oregon, the commission has rules against allowing approval for projects in the IRP that are already in process. When it comes to recovery and rates, projects can already be in progress, but acknowledgement in the IRP must come before the project is in process. I suppose it's more of a comment than a question.
It would be... I don't know that I completely understand what in process means, and if that's better defined somewhere, that's the question that comes to my mind about what is the implication of that. Because I think we're kind of talking about the same thing here. When is something in process versus when is it already well enough advanced to be considered that it's an existing project. So anyway, if whoever offered that comment can provide a specific reference to how that those terms are defined, that would be useful for us.
Okay, I believe this caller has now just raised their hand, so we can go ahead and unmute their line.
Okay, oh good.
This is Jamie McGovern from Oregon, and I believe that that the company is allowed to be in the phase of obviously investigating and doing research, but under construction is I think the benchmark in terms of the IRP process in Oregon. I can get a little more detail for you guys on that, but I was thinking about the issue and the fact that not just recovery but allocation is also a concern. And so if we're talking about projects that are sort of being planned or partly underway or even, you know, fully online and that they bring value to the system but they were sort of started beforehand, then there's a question of, you know, sort of where their rates might be out, you know, sort of justified or where the recovery might be justified as a sort of standalone before the entrance into this connected process. So I guess that is also the concern, is that if you have a project that, you know, sort of was justified at the state level, or individually, and then bringing it in, the question of allocation of the recovery, not just the fact that, you know, whether people are going to pay, you know, the question is, are people going to pay for it or not? That is true, but there's also a question of, you know, where the benefits are flowing. And I think that if a company is able to present a project ahead of time without the consideration of connectivity here, then and justify that to the commission, and then that they're, you know, sort of that's the approved project, or then bringing it in afterwards poses a question of allocation of the cost. That's all.
Okay, thanks. There's a lot there that you cited, so I think when the time comes and you submit written comments, if you could give us a link to documents that we could look up just to understand that better, that would be helpful.
Sure.
Thanks. Okay. Facilities, new facilities. This is the primary bubble. Transmission projects planned and approved in an expanded transmission planning process for the expanded BAA. Now, the idea is that the new process would begin at the same time as the new PTO is integrated into the system. So the PacifiCorp were to join effective, say, January 2019, then the transmission planning cycle that begins January 2019 would be the first instance of the expanded TPP. And under the ISO's current structure, that's a 15-month cycle, which in March 2020 would produce the first plan. So that's the timing we have in mind of how it would work. Whatever is that implementation, that would identify the first planning process. Now, if the integration date is not January, if it's, say, July or August, then the new planning process can't kick off until the following January, because once we, the way the process structure is, we have to, under our tariff, of course it can be modified, but in terms of just being able to get all the work done, we have to, by the end of March, complete our unified planning assumptions and study plan. We lay out essentially all the assumptions, what are the studies we're going to do, and that whole plan is done in the first 3 months by the end of March. So if we don't have definite integration of the new entity by then you know, it would be too, it would be pretty impossible to kind of rejigger the whole planning process later. So that would push it back to another cycle. But in any event, whatever is the first full planning cycle that that can begin once the entity has been fully operational. So timing-wise, that's what that means. We will develop details of what that expanded planning process would look like when we begin some of these later initiatives early 2017. The idea being, though, that whatever is conducted under that new planning process has to provide the studies and the information to support whatever cost allocation and decision rules adopted under the TPP, under the tax structure. And we can expect some pretty strong similarity between how our process works today. Those of you who follow the ISO's transmission planning process, I mean, there's a certain basic logic to it that that says for the first 3 months, we're holding stakeholder activities, getting comments, but we're basically developing assumptions and study plan. And that's finished by the end of March. And that's about a reasonable amount of time to complete that task. Then from that time up until the end of the year, 9 months, we're doing a whole bunch of studies, holding meetings, explaining results, receiving suggestions for possible mitigations or projects to meet certain needs, evaluating all of that. And then by January, a year after the process started, we put out a draft comprehensive plan, which captures what are the ISO planners' recommendations for what ought to be built. And then there's this process and period of review there, so that by March, the plan is taken to the Board of Governors for approval, and the process is done. What happens after that is if there's any competitive solicitation, there's a phase to do that. But in terms of coming up with the plan from beginning to end, 15 months. So a lot of that is really just the logic of you make assumptions and plans before you actually do the studies, and this is how much time it takes, given that we need to look at reliability needs, which are potential future criteria violations that have to be mitigated. We do a certain number of economic studies to determine whether there's opportunities to build economic projects, that is, where the economic would exceed the cost, largely demonstrated through production cost modeling, and then public policy driven. We need to all three of those categories. So those sort of basic parameters of what a planning process would have to look like, we expect would be retained. A lot of specifics will be talked about as we get into it. But in any event, the process has to support the kinds of information that the cost allocation calls for in order to make that allocation. A footnote here, or the last bullet on the side, a project under review as potential interregional prior to joining may be considered new as long as the criteria for existing are not met. And this is a big discussion at our last meeting. You know, when does something cross that? Say, sorry, it's existing. It can't be brought into this process that, as you see, we're still struggling with. Okay? Questions on that one? I guess not.
Okay, Colin, we'll go ahead and take the question on the phone line. Just a reminder to identify yourself first.
Shelly Ann May, TransCanyon. I just have a clarifying question on the last bullet. Would an interregional project be considered new if it is viewed as displacing a project that would otherwise be approved through the expanded transmission planning process?
I didn't quite get the second half of that. Would you say that again?
Yes, sure. My question is, would an interregional project be considered new if it is viewed as displacing a project that would otherwise have been approved through the expanded transmission planning process.
Okay. So I think the answer generally would be yes, that under the expanded planning process, the approach that the planners take is to start with defining what are the needs, what are the objectives they're trying to accomplish. If in the case of a reliability need, it's typically a forecasted future criteria violation that would cause a reliability problem on the system. Case of economics, it's usually identified as a high congestion area or some access to lower cost resources where we would expect enough of an economic benefit to outweigh the cost of the project. In the case of public policy, it's policy objectives that come down from the state or the federal government or some of the states that have an implication on the need for transmission in order to achieve that policy. So these define objectives, and then the planners work to determine what is the most cost-effective way to meet those objectives or to solve the problem, in which case, if there is an interregional project on the table or there's a project that's entirely within the region to be planned solely within the expanded planning process, if both of those are visible in alternatives, either one of them could turn out to be, or neither one of them, maybe something else, could turn out to be the most cost-effective solution to the problem or the best way to meet the need. So I think all of those things are on the table, and then whichever one is picked would qualify as a new project. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good. Can I take the day off now? All right. Nobody else on the phone? Okay. All right. So, proposal for existing facilities. Here we hearken back to where we were in the last straw proposal, which we know everyone loved so much, that transmission revenue requirements for existing facilities will be recovered through subregional license plate tack rates for each subregion, which means that the only facilities eligible for regional cost allocation, that is, allocation to multiple subregions, will be these new facilities approved in the expanded TP. Now, there's a lot of discussion and comment about this. It was not an issue on which there was unanimous opinion. And we actually looked at a number of possible ways to think about some sort of cost sharing for existing facilities and tried a number of different ways to construct that logically on a basis of principle. And frankly, everything was problematic. And the reason is that that principle that I've got in italics in the second bullet, as some folks have already discussed this morning, provides a nice clean way of separating what can get regional cost allocation versus what has to be recovered subregionally. And once you start departing from that principle and making exceptions and weakening it and saying, well, some of the stuff that's in the existing category ought to be shared, then the problem of defining what that boundary is, how to set limits on it, what things to include, what things to exclude, what basis to do it. For example, should we look at facilities that are related to the interchange capacity between the subregions? Should we look at facilities that were built for public policy reasons within the last 5 years? Should we not look at ones that were built within the last 5 years? What about an entity, now a third PTO, that wants to join and says, hey, I'm going to approve a whole bunch of expensive transmission now because there's a rule that says if it was built under these parameters, then it's eligible for sharing the costs with other entities. Everything we looked at had some sort of problems because it was, in one way or another, a somewhat arbitrary departure from the principle of the second bullet that's in italics. And so what we felt was that, and then add to that the fact that the notion of license plate tack rates for different subregions is well established in FERC precedent, seemed to us that we could not come up with something better for what to do about this. So that's where we ended up and why. The last bullet just essentially extends that same principle to a third or fourth or any subsequent PTO that joins. It says basically whatever they bring to the table that was planned in their own separate process as in the existing category, that is, anything that wasn't planned jointly through the expanded process is going to be recovered in their area. And likewise, they will not be responsible for any of the existing facilities that were brought to the mix by the other entities.
Okay, operator, we'll take the question over the phone, please.
This is Shelly Ann May from TransCanyon again. So I'm not sure if you're going to get to this later on, but I just wanted to know whether only facilities subject to regional cost allocation would be open to competition. Is that what you're saying, or is there another message here?
Well, I don't think the message is on this page, but
okay.
The question of open to competition, which let me see if it's later on here. Do we? I don't know if I covered it in the PowerPoint though. Anyway, I'll talk about it now. The principle that we explained in the paper. Is that if the cost allocation for a facility is going to be borne by more than one PTO, then it's open to competitive solicitation.
Okay.
So largely what that means, I mean, the first part of what you said is correct, that if it is approved for regional cost allocation across multiple subregions, then yes, it is open to competitive solicitation. And in addition, if it may be approved only for cost allocation within a single subregion, but the cost allocation crosses multiple PTOs within that subregion, then under FERC Order 1000, it would still be open to competitive solicitation. So that, for example, in the current ISO footprint, 230 kV facilities, the facility may be determined that it's, completely a subregional facility for the existing CAISO footprint, but the cost allocation crosses our three major PTO service territories and costs are shared by all of the PTOs, including some of the smaller ones, then that makes it subject to competitive solicitation as well. In FERC Order 1000 terms, it's only the ones that are local, that is truly within a single PTO, that would not be subject to competitive solicitation.
Thank you. That answers my question. Thanks.
Okay. You're welcome.
Okay, operator, we'll take the next question.
Hi, this is Ben Tanzi at California Energy Markets. This may be an oversimplification or it may be explained by the first bullet point there, but I just wanted to find out if we can say with certainty under the proposal that you now have out, is it the case that none of the eight energy gateway segments would be considered a new project?
I think we can't say none of the eight. The ones that are built that are existing would be existing. Ones that are not yet I think as was discussed earlier, some being discussed in the interregional coordination planning process may potentially be considered new projects if they are taken up in an expanded planning process that is created later.
All right, thank you.
This is Jan Strack from San Diego Gas Electric. I just wanted to follow up on the earlier question about competition. So if, for example, and this is strictly an example, if UAMPS were to become a PTO, would that then mean that any, I guess, above 200 kV reliability projects in the Pacific Coast subregion would then be subject to competition because there would be a sharing of cost? UAMPS and Pacific Corps, is that, did I put that correct?
That's my understanding, okay. That and that if UAMPS is a PTO and they bear some of the costs of that subregional facility, it's now being paid by more than one PTO, yes.
Okay, operator, we'll take the next question in the queue.
Hi, this is Nora Scherer for CRECA. Lorenzo, I have a question about your assumption that existing costs would remain with the existing PTOs. And I may be trying to connect too many dots here, but from the benefit study results in the presentations last week on the expanded regional market, it seemed to me that one of the assumptions that was being made there was that there would be full de-pancaking of all transmission access charges across the entire regional ISO by 2030. So that would be a change from what is being proposed in this tax straw proposal, correct?
Yeah, this is John. Can you explain why you think that the ISO's proposal wouldn't result in de-pancaking of rates across the expanded region?
Well, don't you say the existing tax stay with the existing PTOs?
Right, but the load in that sub-region would pay a single rate, and they would have access to the entire region, and that rate would be the sub-regional rate plus any regional costs that were shared by that sub-region. So we view that as de-pancaking. It's not a postage stamp rate, so not everybody in the region is paying the same rate, but we still view it as de-pancaking of rate. If you disagree, just help us understand why you think that.
Okay. No, I think you've clarified the point for me. Thank you.
All right. Continuing right along. Okay. Revised straw proposal, new facilities. So, starting off with two steps for determining eligibility. Number one, this is the definition of the lovely large bubble. Facility must be planned and approved through the integrated TPP for the expanded BAA. This makes it a new facility, but to make it a new regional facility that is eligible for regional cost allocation, one of the following three proposals. Either it needs a voltage rating of above 200. Last proposal, we had stated 300 there. Due to a lot of comments, which kind of argued both directions, lowered this threshold to 200 to make it more consistent with the entire high voltage category. It seemed like that consistency makes sense. Or be it interconnects or increases interconnection capacity between two subregions, in which case it could be at a lower voltage if it achieves that interregional benefit or or C, it creates increases or supports increase of intertie between the expanded VAA and a neighbor. And again, if it does that, it could also be a lower voltage, but it achieves that electrical benefit. Cost of facilities not meeting any of these criteria will be allocated entirely to the subregion in which they are built and interconnected. So that much is pretty much consistent with where we were before, with the exception of A, which we just adjusted that threshold. But now, moving on to the cost allocation part of that, did you want to ask the question before I move to the next slide?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul. Paul Nelson from Edison. So on B and C, you did say that within a voltage that's less than 200 would qualify if it meets B or C.
Yeah.
This seems to be a little bit different because earlier in the slide you sort of said that you wanted to keep the existing below 200 costs within the PTO as they're currently done today.
Yeah.
So this seems to be a bit contradictory to what was said on the other slide.
Good point. I think we probably need to refine this a little bit, but we're picking up the idea that several parties mentioned in their comments that has been used in some of the other ISO areas where something is a necessary facility to support something else. And so if you're, say, doing an upgrade on an interchange capacity, but you can't get the value of it without doing this other piece that might be at a lower capture that idea. Sometimes things are essential in order to realize the electrical benefit of the other thing you're building.
Again, it kind of creates interesting differences because, you know, those less than 200 kW interconnections between, like, Southern California Edison and PG&E, but then, like SE has a connection with Nevada Energy that's, like, 115, and if that then gets, I'm not sure how, upgrades included?
It could be an upgrade, yeah.
So then that would treat it a little bit differently than if it connects. So it just creates differences.
Say that again?
Well, I mean, if there's an upgrade between of a 115 facility between Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric, I mean, today then it will all be recovered from SC's customers and that low voltage rate. But if it's an interconnection with, say, Nevada Energy, then and it's upgrade, now you're going to then spread that cost. But you're going to treat it almost like it was a high voltage. So you've got interesting differences between PTOs that were in the existing CAISO footprint and PTOs that are not in the existing footprint. And it goes back to, I guess I'll bring it up now because I had this one question on the whole issue of competition because right now if there's a reliability facility, I'll pause here because you were taking notes.
No, I'm just,
because I'm moving on to a different issue now.
Okay.
So right now, if there's a reliability line completely within SC's footprint, that's 220, because those spread are costs and a postage stamp, it's subject to competition. Mm-hmm. The question I have is if Pacific Corp is their own subregion or Nevada Energy, because I'm not trying to cite one person, but they do a 220 line completely within their footprint, is that subject to competition? Because it won't get spread across between other regions, so it will or will not be subject to competition.
Because it's completely within the subregion and within a single PTO.
Okay, so that would not be.
It would not be subject to competition.
So Pacific Corp can bid on projects within the CAISO footprint, but the PTOs within the existing CAISO footprint cannot bid on projects within Pacific Corp under that circumstance. Here again, going back to principles and trying to create.
Hold on a second. I'm having a conference with counsel here. Start a counsel.
Okay. No. Thanks, Paul.
Smart man.
So I think both of your points are well taken, and they are they arise from the fact that we're trying to create subregions and. The differences between those subregions due to the history in California results
in these differences in going forward, right? In whether it's the competition or the interconnection with Nevada versus PG&E and those kind of things, those examples that you raised, we, I think, have tried to design the proposal to, as much as possible, maintain the treatment of existing PTOs within the ISO, what would be the ISO subregion, going forward. But that does then give rise to these differences that you're pointing out. And I'd ask you, I don't know if you have any thoughts on solutions to that, or is this something that needs to be addressed, or is it something that's acceptable, or just kind of help us understand your thinking on that.
Yeah, I mean, what you're doing with the subregion to cover sort of embedded existing costs, I understand what you're, where you're going with this. And the fact is today, in the current footprint, we merged them all together. I mean, there was a transition plan, and I realized that doing that with PacifiCorp is just, it would be off the table for them to join if we did that. I mean, I understand that. So for the, I understand what you're doing with the subregions in terms of how to deal with existing costs. But the subregion definitions, it goes back to how you're going moving forward in the future, sets up where I was going with this example is non-California PTOs can compete on projects within the current CAISO footprint, but then we are now prohibited from competing there. And I'm like, that doesn't seem very fair.
So are you suggesting that then there would be a different rules that would apply for cost allocation purposes versus competitive solicitation purposes and these other?
One option is you still have those, just like you're going down, those reliability projects solely within a PTO and subregion, you know, stays in those subregion, but that project is open to competition. So you've separated cost allocation from how things are subject to competition, mm-hmm. so that you're not creating different treatment for. I'm afraid to use the word discriminatory treatment, but I think I'll use it anyway.
You could use inconsistent.
Certainly inconsistent, and I'll leave it up to the attorneys to determine if it's considered discriminatory.
Well, you know, we have due discrimination and undue discrimination,
So that may be something
to
think about.
That's a good point, Paul.
You know, how you do cost allocation and how you do what's subject to competition may have different some different standards.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Thank you.
Hi, Dave Smith with Transwest. Just to pick up on the point just made, my understanding of the tariff now is that policy and economic transmission projects are open to competition. And so the definition is more about the project type. So I'm not sure why the cost allocation mechanisms is being brought in, or the cost, you know, where it's being spread across is being brought in. So, you know, if you have a policy project that is being approved as a policy project, but it doesn't do cost allocation between different subregions, I don't know what that means. So I'm not sure you're planning. Are you suggesting to change?
When you say now, do you mean how the ISO currently does it today?
Yeah, that's my understanding of what's eligible for competition, what isn't. It doesn't have anything to do with the cost allocation as much as it has to do with what type of project it is.
No, it has to do with what voltage level it is. It's above 200 kV.
Even a reliability upgrade project?
Yep.
Oh,
everything.
Okay.
Yeah. So the current system for the ISO footprint is purely based on the 200 kV threshold for cost allocation and for eligibility for competition.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No, no problem. Okay. Oh, sure.
Okay. Brad Mullins for ICNU. So on these three criteria, if there's a policy project that does not meet these three criteria, is it true that will be directly assigned to the subregion where the policy project is interconnected?
That's the proposal at this point, yes.
Okay. All right. That's my question. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, operator, we'll take the questions on the phone line.
Hi, everybody. This is David Oliver with Navigant. So on point B there, can you hear me?
Yes. Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. On point B there, it says it increases the interconnection capacity between two subregions. Does this mean a project less than 200 kilovolts that is, say, would reduce congestion between at the between two subregions, maybe eliminate a RAS or support a higher nomogram, could not be considered a new regional facility for these purposes?
No, I think it would. I think it could under these criteria, because it's, if it's essentially having the effect of increasing the transfer capacity, then
so you're not when you say interconnection capacity between two regions, you kind of mean that in a kind of a broad sense, and not kind of a the actual physical capacity on an interconnection.
Well, the physical facility that comprises the interconnection itself may not be changed, but it could be that it has more usable or schedulable capacity because this other upgrade is relieving some constraint that was preventing it from all being used.
Okay. Thank you. That helps.
That's the idea.
All right, Tim, next question, please.
Shelly and May, TransCanyon. I'd like to go back to one of the examples that was given earlier of a project being constructed in PacifiCorp's footprint that is over 200 kV. Yeah. And if I understand what was said earlier is that that project would not be subject to competition, but if that is correct, if that was what was stated earlier, I would like to understand why it would not be subject to competition if it meets the criteria of being a new regional facility.
If it meets the criteria for being a regional facility, then it would be open to competition. If it doesn't meet the criteria and it's just within PacifiCorp's territory, then the question of whether it's open to competition really depends on how the cost is being allocated within PacifiCorp, specifically whether there is more than one participating transmission owner whose territory is paying part of those costs. So it goes to the question that was asked a little while ago about if UAMPS decides to become a participating transmission owner, then a facility, a 230 that's built within PacifiCorp's territory for which UAMPS was responsible for part of the cost would now no longer be a local facility in FERC Order 1000 terms. And therefore,
okay.
It's open to competitive solicitation.
Okay, but if the project is over 200 kV, it would meet the definition under your proposal of being a new regional facility, and therefore it would be cost allocated across multiple regions, correct? And so that multiple sub-regions, I should say. And so that project should be subject to competition. And I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that.
Okay. So the one caveat I would put on that, which is on the next slide that we haven't gotten to, and if you remember going back to the previous proposal a couple of months ago, all of the criteria that are listed on this slide were essentially like admission tickets to be considered for regional cost allocation based on benefits methodologies that we had described in that proposal. Now, I'll get to it on the next slide, instead of benefits methodologies, we're talking about the decisions of a multi-state body, which may decide something different about the cost allocation. So what's on this slide is really eligibility for regional cost allocation, that is across multiple subregions, but it doesn't automatically say determine what that regional cost allocation would look like.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, John wants to add.
Yeah, but I would say, but if the end result of that regional cost allocation consideration is an allocation of cost to multiple subregions, then that principle would apply, and I would suspect that it would be open to competitive solicitation.
Okay.
Tony Braun for CMUI. Just a quick clarifying question. If there is a line, a high voltage line above 200 kV that is, for example, in PACE and it interconnects to a neighboring BAA to the east, do I understand 2C to mean that it would be eligible for treatment as a regional facility?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. All right.
All right, Tim, we'll take the question on the phone.
And could we have you please dial #2? Thank you. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Padmini Balbe from Western Area Power Administration. I just have a question. How would an enhancement to an existing facility that would meet both B and C criteria be treated in relationship to this slide? Would it be considered then a new regional facility, whether it is under 200 kV or above 200 kV?
If it meets criteria B or and C or and or C, it would be eligible for regional cost allocation by virtue of expanding or enhancing either the interconnection between subregions or between the expanded BAA and a neighbor. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Okay, cost allocation for new regional facilities. So, things that have passed all of the hurdles on the previous slide, now looking at slide number 16. Different treatment for reliability projects versus economic or policy driven. Reliability projects, and we want to just really consider this a narrow category where there's a project identified to meet a specific reliability need within a subregion, then all the cost goes to that subregion, and it gets included in the license plate rate. Now, we recognize that there could be projects that have reliability benefits, and so we're not talking about those. We're really talking about things that are really narrowly defined, designed, specified in their engineering details, et cetera, to meet a specific reliability problem that arose within a single. Everything else would now go to a proposed body of state regulators that would essentially look at what the needs are, perhaps the results of transmission planning studies and recommendations, and would make decisions as to what facilities should be built and what would be the fair cost allocation among the participating states and entities. That body, at this point, this proposal does not really try to add more specificity to than that. Largely for the reason that this gets us into the bigger governance questions, which this initiative is really parallel to or separate from and not trying to preempt or prefigure. But the idea being that as that new governance structure is created and designed, that one of the subsidiary activities, if you like, would be this body to decide on regional cost allocation for facilities that benefit the expanded region. The concept comes from what was done in two of the other multi-state ISOs, ISO New England and Mid-Continent ISO, MISO, both of which had at a certain point in time brought their constituent states together to decide on a set of transmission upgrades to benefit the entire region and what the cost allocation would look like. And on that basis, FERC basically took the recommendations of the ISO based upon the preferences of the state committees and what they wanted to do. And we know from precedent that agreement among the parties as to the cost allocation is an important condition for FERC approval, because there's also plenty of instances where cost allocation for transmission has been litigated, which ends up being costly for everybody. And so being able to get ex ante agreement on the fairness and appropriateness of building a set of facilities and sharing the costs for them is a good way to ensure that things can go through. So the idea here is to say, look, we spent a lot of time thinking about benefits methods, which are, no matter what, imprecise, maybe good enough. We talked about the DFACS method, which almost everybody disliked. We talked about TEAM, which is what the ISO uses for economic benefits analysis, which may be useful and applicable, and maybe we would still use it for study purposes to provide information. But in terms of having the kind of final word on benefits assessment come from the ISO process, we felt that, well, maybe this multi-state approach, as MISO and I have done, would be a more appropriate way to do things here. So that's the idea that we put out in this process. Denise.
Denise Parrish, Wyoming OCA. Two comments on this. One is, and perhaps you're just going to again reference that it's part of the governance process, but we understand that some discussion about this body of state regulators was done at Western Conference, and some of us were not privy to that discussion. So having a better understanding of at least what's in the works on that would be helpful to those of us who weren't participants in those discussions, and especially the consumer advocates, what our role in that would be, and how what sort of public process there would be for input in that regard. Secondly, having been involved not from the beginning in 1989, but pretty close, starting in 1991, I have been involved in a Pacific Core cost allocation process that was generated from the merger of Utah Power and Pacific Power, and 25 years later we are still working on those cost allocations. So it's not clear to me that is really an ideal situation, having my view colored from the fact that we can't agree on intra-company, interstate cost allocations. It's not clear how this new process would work any better than that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's anyone here who can. Virginia, did you want to? You're standing up.
There is nothing solidified yet. I believe there's just some ideas going around. There will be a follow-up to the May 6th discussion. That was the CEC held workshop on governance. That will be, I believe that there's another session to follow up to that that's being proposed, and hopefully we'll have those dates soon. And I imagine that this will be one of the topics that will be discussed in the next round as we kind of hone in on a better proposal.
Okay, but no date for that?
No, I believe the date's going to be announced within the next week or so, so we'll be putting some dates out. This will be another CEC-held workshop. As we imagine it, today, the CEC is going to continue its leadership in that field, and we will just participate in that process as well.
Yeah. Jan Stratt from San Diego Gas Electric. I'm not going to comment on the governance issue here. I'm sure we're going to have something more to say about that elsewhere. A couple of things here. First of all, it says here decisions to build will be determined by the state regulators. I think that's sort of a statement of existing fact because the ISO doesn't make any decisions to build. That's a decision by other parties. The ISO is responsible for approving cost recovery, basically, the way I see it. So maybe that'll that.
Right.
You might want to
good point.
Kind of clarify that here. My second comment is on the methodology in the transmission planning process. And Lorenzo, you touched on this briefly, but I guess I would just encourage in the proposal that at the ISO management level, that the team methodology be applied to all projects, and that recommendation at least go to whomever the ultimate governing authority is. I think it's important to maintain that sort of integral part of the transmission planning process.
Okay, thank you.
It's more comfortable. Yeah, you can remove the mic.
This is Tim Haynes with the California State Water Contractors. In the public workshop that you held for the first draft of your TAC proposal, the ISO disclosed that it was negotiating a transition agreement with PacifiCorp that would have waived certain provisions of the proposal, thus allowing PacifiCorp to be able to construct, if approved through the regional transmission planning process, construct the final segments of the Gateway project, not competitively bid those sections, and allow for the regional allocation of the cost for those facilities. And I'm assuming that the transition agreement is continuing to be negotiated. And the question that I would have is, would that transition agreement bind or limit the determination of the body of state regulators as to how the costs of the gateway facilities would be allocated?
Thanks, Tim. You are correct. The transition agreement does remain under consideration with PacifiCorp and the ISO. I think the key to your question really is that we want to focus attention on these core principles. I think one of the core principles that we did talk about today, and it's articulated in the straw proposal, is that new regional facilities will be eligible for open to competitive solicitation. So we want to really focus in on the principles and not to come to any conclusions about the transition agreement until we've come to some understanding on these core principles.
I think the point that I was trying to get at is that when we start the governance discussions, I think, are predicated on the notion that non-California states want a say in how it is that costs could potentially be allocated to the consumers in their state. And my question is more along the lines of so you come up with the notion of a body of state regulators that will be involved in the allocation of cost. My question is, does the transition agreement limit what this body of state regulators is going to be able to determine as to the allocation of the costs of a gateway project?
So the transition agreement remains under discussion, but I think it would be counterproductive to attempt to limit the principle associated with the body of state regulators and their decisions with respect to cost allocation of regional transmission, you know, projects. So I think it would be counterproductive. I mean, I think that you've answered your own question. I think it would just be sort of insane, to be extreme, to come up with a delegation or something, you know, consistent with this principle in a governance discussion that's happening at levels above, you know, this
higher
group's
up
conversation.
The food chain.
Yeah,
no, I get it.
And then to attempt to sneak that into FERC or something like that. Yeah.
And then I think that you also indicated that the plan was to disclose the transition agreement sometime around the time when you're going to the board for their decision on the TAC proposal. Is that still the plan?
So currently the plan is to continue the discussions concerning the transition agreement. We do expect that when those discussions are concluded, that we would then go to the board, but the timing of all that, you know, remains, you know, to be determined at this point. I don't know when that would occur.
Thank you.
Okay, Tim, looks like we have a couple hands raised in the queue, so we'll go ahead and take the questions.
This is Pushkar Wagle here from Clean RCA. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Hi, Lorenzo. So the quick question regarding, you know, what gets spread over multiple sub-region in terms of cost allocation, would it be an accurate characterization that it needs to be an economic and policy-driven facility itself? So I think your proposal has a footnote about that an economic or a policy-driven transmission project, which also has reliability benefits to specific sub-region, that probably part is ignored and it would be purely classified as an economic or policy-driven project because that's the primary justification for the project?
Yes, I would tend to agree with that. I think the reason for the first bullet on this page really goes to those very narrowly defined projects that are really intended only to meet a reliability issue within a sub-region. Now, in our current planning process, just to give you an illustration, when the ISO is, say, considering an economic project, it may be that the project under consideration for economic benefits may have the additional benefit of offsetting the need for a reliability project we would have had to build. So there's some avoided cost that you get from that, from avoiding that project, and it satisfies that need, but the project really does a lot more than just meet the reliability need. So it would be categorized as an economic project. Similarly, you could have the same kind of thing for a policy project. So it's those things that have the bigger benefits beyond simply addressing a reliability need at a, I don't want to use the word local, but at a sub-region specific level.
I guess the devil would be in the details in terms of what would be the primary justification. I guess we have had within the ISO TPP process several projects that are approved as a policy-driven project, but did have reliability benefits and vice versa. I would say you're talking about what is the most dominating classification for the project approval, and if that is economic or policy, then it would be spread over, it could be potentially, the cost of that could be spread over multiple subregions, whereas if the dominating part is reliability for a specific subregion, then it would be license plate for that specific subregion.
Yeah, that's the basic idea. I would also refer to the logic of how we conduct our transmission planning process, because we start out with looking at the potential future criteria violations that would give rise to a need for a reliability project. We start there. We do all of those reliability studies with our PTOs, and, you know, in August, September, we come up with a set of mitigations for those problems. And so that's kind of the starting place. Then when we look at economic studies or when we look at policy needs, it's really based on an assumption that we're going to fix those reliability needs somehow, and we've got proposed mitigations for them. Now, it could turn out that one of those later projects, for economic or policy reasons, enables us to eliminate or reduce the cost of the reliability upgrade, so there's benefits from some avoided cost. But the project, the later project, is essentially an economic project or a policy-driven project because it would not have been built just to meet that reliability need.
Okay. I we'll have some follow-up questions and comments on that. Thank you.
Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E. In the scenario you just described, you talked about replacing a reliability project with an economic project or a policy project that has broader benefit. Is it your expectation that the determination on how to allocate the cost of the project that's actually built be left to that body of state regulators, or will there be some principles in the ISO tariff that will guide those state regulators in how they decide to allocate the cost, whether they're a portion at the sub-region and another portion at the regional level? How do you envision that working?
Well, that's a really good question. I think as this state body evolves, we may have some kind of guidelines that would be recommended. For example, when in our prior proposal, we had the idea of applying the team analysis to determine economic benefits for a project. And if it was a reliability project that had economic benefits beyond meeting the reliability need, then some portion of the cost commensurate with those benefits might be allocated more broadly, and the remaining cost might be allocated locally. I'm talking off the top of my head right now, but I'm just saying that the idea of having some kind of guiding principles that would be recommended might be part of the consideration of how that given guidance, for example. Frowning.
Tony Ron for CMUA. Perhaps this is stating the obvious on this, and we're still thinking this through how we feel about this, but this isn't going to happen overnight, right? So it's going to be years probably.
We'll have the answer tomorrow morning.
Before the state body of regulators, regional state committee, OMS type structure is even in place, it's going to be quite a while. So we're going to have a gap of some period of time, probably measured in years, it would seem reasonable, where you've got to form this entity and then it has to reach a determination of what it wants to do. So that would be an interesting window into how this will affect the planning process. So then just as an observation here, because you guys are making me hopeful that I'm going to be able to make the 305 flight, I want to get this in, is that the conundrum that the choice that you've made here from a process standpoint presents is that from an equity standpoint, our exposure to future costs affects how we feel about the allocation of existing costs. So you've nailed down one part of the equation but left the other part of the equation open-ended. And so it's difficult to really craft a package and determine whether the entire package is just and reasonable here. And so this is something that we'll be wrestling with. I think you'll probably hear that in our comments.
Yeah, thanks, Tony.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express, and I share Tony's observation that this could be years before
the body of regulators are prepared to make decisions. In the interim, you do have an interregional planning process and your own planning process and needs to meet the requirements of SB 350. I was wondering, this body of state regulators with respect to the California regulator, is there a difference that you see in their role in this process that you're describing here?
And, difference compared to what
today?
Well, we don't have such a thing today.
Right. So you make the decisions now on what to invest.
As it is right now, the ISO's planning process comes up with the recommended projects. We take them to our Board of Governors, and the Board of Governors' approval essentially amounts to approval to recover costs through the transmission access requirement. There still is the question of going to the local regulatory authority, which in most cases is the CPUC, for siting approval for CPCN for environmental review. So the state has its decision process on top of that. But it's the ISO.
Right, but that's probably not, back to Jan's point, you say build. It's probably more to invest and not, but you're not looking for this board to also give you the CPCN, are you? This body of state regulators?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think it replaces whatever are the state regulatory processes, but it takes the place of, instead of the ISO and its governing board making the decisions of what's in the plan.
So if you had this proposal and yes, but you weren't expanding, right, you would be inserting the CPUC in the decision-making process. Is that correct? Is that how I should think of how you're proposing to change the process?
Well, I see where you're going. That kind of makes sense, but what I would point out is, in a sense, this is trying to take something that we already do with the CPs and expand it to a bigger region, because today, when we are looking at policy-driven projects, we're getting input from the CPUC on what they view as the procurement portfolio that their regulated entities are going to be signing contracts with, or the areas of the state, perhaps, that are preferred for developing renewable resources. They're telling us that procurement information, which count in deciding, well, which transmission projects ought to be built to meet this policy. So we have, and we have a whole MOU on that with the PUC.
Right.
So we have a certain.
You have an MOU. You don't have a tariff on it, right? So I'm just trying to understand what the real material differences are. It sounds like, I would guess that this decision would be made after a lot of analysis is done, where what you just described, is kind of a proactive set of portfolios coming from the PUC based on an MOU understanding you have, I'm just trying to understand what the difference is. And then my question is, why do you see that as necessary, just in the California context?
Well, I don't think we see it as necessary if we were just going to be a California-only entity. Okay? I think the way the process is largely working today would not need this kind of a dramatic change. What we're trying to do is take something that's working relationship between ISO and PUC today. Yes, it's under an MOU and not tariff, but it's essentially a level that guides transmission planning from the state perspective, state procurement perspective. How can we take something comparable to that and create it for multiple states so that it will guide choices of transmission projects and how to allocate those costs?
Okay, thank you for that. And then my other question is, again, you have this interregional transmission planning process that's going to look at, needs for SB 350 with regional projects. Is there a role for this body of state regulators in there, and do you see them getting involved in the interregional planning process? I know that NTTG has state regulators on their board, as well as WestConnect has a position. I don't know if they have anyone. And I don't believe that ISO has that level of involvement.
No. What I would imagine is, so let's hypothetical is that PacifiCorps joins the ISO and create a larger BAA. Now we are the new region. So an interregional planning process would be between
I guess I was looking at more of that transition from an interregional transmission project going into the regional process. Because you said those would be eligible.
Oh, okay. Oh, you mean projects that are already being looked at as interregionally.
Correct.
Right. Well, I think it would, the state board, state body of regulators would have the same role with regard to those as well, because it comes back to the integrated planning process would still be looking at what the needs are and making recommendations as to what we think are the best project solutions to meet those needs, perhaps with some alternatives, but you know, there would be a body of analysis and recommendations that comes out of the planning process for that body to work on, which could include a project that's currently in the interregional consideration. Yeah.
This is Alyssa Koo from PG&E, and I'm sorry, I'm still not quite clear on the concept. I was wondering how this decisions to build procedure, which will be determined by the body of state regulators, kind of relates to the expanded TPP. Is the body of state regulators going to take over the TPP process, or will the expanded ISO do some kind of TPP process, come up with proposed projects, and then the body of state regulators somehow decides whether or not those are really going to get built, or I'm just wondering how it...
So, again, this is a ways off from actually being worked out, but I think all of the engineering analysis, cost benefits, team studies, whatever, the expanded planning process needs to do all of that, okay? It needs to do the studies that identify the economic studies. It needs to take the policies and somehow come up with a plan that policy objectives, looks at potential alternatives. So I think there will still be an that does the analysis of needs and makes recommendations. Now, it would stop short of the question of how much cost should be shared among which entities and leave to the body of state regulators. For example, with an economic project, we have no obligation to build an economic project. We do a projected benefits are 1.1 times the projected cost. Well, we're not compelled to build that project. It still could be a state regulator's decision to say, you know, we don't want to because it's not absolutely necessary. We'll live with the congestion. So, you know, those are the kinds of choices that would then go, I think, to that body.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, Tim, we have a couple questions in the queue. We'll take the first question, please.
This is David Oliver with Navigant Pertank. Just a couple of questions that since somebody else in our group has been following the regional governance, would this create, when you come up with a final proposal, which obviously you haven't done yet, but at the end of August or whatever, and it's approved by the board, would this create a mandate within the regional governance process to create the rules and the charter, if you will, for this body of state regulators, or would that be handled as well within a stakeholder process such as this? And my second question is, and I guess it's kind of a follow-up on the last one, so the CalISO would do the TPP for the expanded region, and they would bring it before this body who would say yes or no on a project and cost allocation, and then that would go to the full expanded board. Is that how you foresee this going? And a third point is, not all entities, there are public utilities that don't answer necessarily to the CPUC on certain things, and how would you see them being part of this body of state regulators in some form or another? Thanks.
I don't think we can, through this TAC proposal, create a mandate on a governance process to do something. I think we would, through what we file in our recommendation, is, in a sense, be contingent on this entity being created as part of the governance process. But we can't require that through ISO TAC rules.
Okay with that?
Okay. The second question about the Board of Governors.
Yeah, I mean, would it go from TPP, so, like the staff of the CalISO, to this body of state regulators, and then from there a final approval needed by the Board of Governors, or whatever comes up within this this new regional governance proposal?
I think that's. Go ahead, John.
I think if I understand your question, so there'd kind of be a fork in the road out of the transmission planning process. So reliability projects would go to the new regional board, and economic and policy projects would go to the new body of state body, and the decisions would be.
Well, I'm also wondering then, after if it goes to the body of state regulators, if then it would also then still be required to go to the full board, which is still to be determined.
That's to be determined, yeah.
Third question, what was the third one?
The third one was about how public utilities would be treated within this body of state regulators, and I suppose that's probably detailed to be worked out, so maybe.
Yeah, I think I don't know what we can say about that. Now, I understand, I recognize the need for sort of the non-PUC type entities to have a voice somehow. I think that's going to have to be worked out through the governance process as well.
Thank you.
Well, let me just take the next one on the phone. I've been waiting in queue, and then we'll take yours. So, operator, you can go ahead and open up the phone line of the second person in the queue.
Caller, your line is open.
Hi, I'm sorry, I was on mute. This is Shalyan May from TransCanyon. I just want to go back to your proposal on cost allocation of reliability projects, just to make sure that I understand what you're proposing here. So if you have a reliability project that is over 200 kV, are you proposing that the cost of that project would be allocated in its entirety to the local PTO on a license plate basis? Is that your proposal? I just want to make sure I understand.
It would be allocated to the subregion on a license plate basis. Okay, the subregion may comprise more than one PTO, but it would be the subregion.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Paul, you're next.
Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. So the body of state regulation, they're determining cost. I mean, in reality, actually, it's going to be FERC that actually decides the cost allocation, since it would be FERC jurisdictional cost. Correct?
Yeah.
So that language there was probably not going to be approved if it was placed into a tariff. And so I'm struggling with, you know, you're trying to get to a tariff to get taken from FERC on cost allocation. Is this going to be a sufficient detail for FERC to approve?
Well, I would say probably not. And we may have to, in a sense, make something that's more like a conceptual filing at FERC on some of these pieces, because of the fact that the governance process will have to figure out some of this stuff before it's ready for tariff language. So what we're looking for here, at least on this part of it, because we really can't provide enough detail from where we sit looking at the TAC initiative to figure out exactly how this thing's going to work, is to see how far we can advance it as a conceptual proposal and then hand off to the governance process to figure out, and ultimately it may be there that the tariff language is created.
I don't have a super long experience dealing with FERC, but from kind of what I've seen is they tend to like to see, you know, things fairly specific in detail, especially when it comes to cost. So.
Yeah, and we agree with that. I mean, it's just a question of what's the process for getting there, you know, and there's only so much we can decide here. When we did MRTU, you may remember, you were engaged in a bunch of that. We had a whole series over a period of a couple of years of conceptual filings, market design filings that we made, and got for guidance on. I call it guidance. It wasn't a ruling, but it helped shape what we ultimately filed as the tariff in 2006.
Okay.
You know, so maybe something like that works here.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt your phone. So Tony Braun again for CMUA. So just on that point,
yes.
Lorenzo and John. So we're also considering that issue of the how you're potentially presenting this to FERC. I think our initial consideration is our experience in the MRTU guidance order process wasn't particularly a happy one. There wasn't a lot of detail associated with the conceptual filings enough to really take a solid position. And then when the detail was provided and people said, well, I've got a concern about that, it was treated almost as a collateral tack on the guidance order that had come out from FERC. So that's a concern that we have. We look forward to how you get, you know, further detail on this. If you took it to your board as a conceptual and then it went no further, I think we'd probably get comfortable with it in shorter order.
Okay, so here is the immediate dilemma in front of us. It's 12:20. I have two slides which I think may be relatively quick details to finish up and let everybody go. Or we could take a lunch break and come back and talk some more. How many would like to plow on through and finish up? Raise your hands. How many would like to break right now and come back and talk more?
Anybody have a granola bar for the guy in the back?
What's that?
Did anybody have a granola bar for the back?
What's that? Yeah, I think we can get through this pretty fast because it's details that I think, well, anyway, let's give it a try. Sorry for those who are hungry, but hang in there. Looking at page 17 now, some additional considerations and provisions. It'll be up on the screen in a moment. One of the things is that FERC Order 1000 does require the ISO to have backup provisions to approve and allocate costs of needed economic or policy-driven projects. So right now we don't have what that backup procedure would be. We've deferred to the back one. We've laid out this idea of deferring to a body of state regulators to make decisions about building and cost allocation for economic and public policy-driven projects. We recognize the need for ISO backstop provisions if that body is not making decisions. We are currently thinking about what that might look like. Don't have it ready to provide at this point because we want to think through a little bit more different ways that that might play out. So look for that in the next round. Another point on this slide, the second point, something we did not address in the previous proposal, but we just didn't want to leave it as a gap, is a region-wide export rate. If you just take the notion of license plate rates for the existing facilities, each subregion now has its own license plate rate, which if you just left it at that, you export from current ISO footprint, you pay one rate, you export from PacifiCorp footprint, you pay a What Eastern ISOs do, what we are proposing to do, is to have one rate no matter where you export from the system, as long as it's high voltage. If it's if you're exporting on an above 200 kV facility, anywhere in the system, you pay the same rate on those exports. And we would load-weighted average of the license plate rates, and then if there is any postage stamp component that is also part of the charge, then that gets added on as well. So it would be somewhere in between the rates that are paid by the different subregions, somewhere in between the highest and lowest, the load. So that's the idea, to create that region-wide rate. Lynette, do you want to jump in?
I do have a question. This is Lynette Kozlowski from PG&E. You mentioned that you would have a blended rate.
No.
Do you also have in mind how you would allocate the revenues collected under that weighted rate, who those revenues would go to, and how they might affect the customers of the PTOs?
Yeah. I think the allocation would follow the same weighting as the rate itself. In other words, a proportional share. The reason why you're weighting it a certain way is because the revenue requirements in each area are being distributed in a certain way that you want those to be the same proportions, in other words.
And have you done any cost analysis on the impact of current ISO participants on the reduction that would result in the revenues collected because of the weighting?
No, we have not yet.
Hi, Dave Smith again with Transwest. Appreciate you haven't worked out this backstop provision yet. I think what I'd like to suggest is that, you know, this group had been working on a first pitch, if you will, on how to do things. And I think if you continue to do that, inserted this regulatory piece in the middle, then you can really think about what your backstop is going to be on the back end as well. Because, you know, I think to Tony's point, you took care of one thing, but there needs to be a proposal here or something. That first pitch is what you would fall back to, I would think.
I see. Okay.
But right now it's just, you know, let's turn it over to this group and some indeterminate time later we'll have an answer. Doesn't sound like a responsible operator.
Okay. Good point.
Now this is Jan.
You can lift
it
out, Jan.
Pardon?
You can lift the mic out.
I can't help but make the suggestion, Lorenzo, on the wheeling out rate.
Mm-hmm.
Just reduce it to zero. That really makes things simpler.
But a weighted average of zeros. Yeah, okay. Okay.
Hi, Denise Parrish, Wyoming OCA. I'm confused and have been trying to think through what you said on the prior slide about when the question came up about not having more specific language to put in the FERC tariff about the state regulators and what they might do. And you made some comment about, well, we might create some concepts to put in the FERC tariff to address more specificity. Could you just expand on that? Because I'm not tracking what you're
okay,
saying.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it would not be concepts in the tariff, because tariff language, as was pointed out, really does need to be precise. So, but what we have done in the past, and we did it with our market redesign process in the 2000s, from about between 2003 and 2005, was a complete massive market redesign for all the ISO markets. And we made, really at FERC's suggestion, a series of conceptual filings on how the new markets would be designed, and put those, they're fairly detailed. We worked through stakeholder processes. Comments. We did a lot of the normal things with the stakeholder process, made the filings, and FERC gave us what they called guidance orders based on those conceptual filings that only later 2006, we put all these pieces together and made a big tariff filing. So I'm just suggesting that an idea here may be, because there are so many pieces of this region-wide expansion that all need to come together, that for some parts of this, we may not be able to crystallize it in precise tariff language at this point in time, to instead put a conceptual filing in front of FERC for their guidance. And then at a later time, it becomes very tariff language. That's the idea. It's not a decision yet, but it's just something we're thinking about, because it does have some precedent and past experience.
This is Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. I understand what you're saying, but I mean, I guess that struck me as, you know, there's something completely new that hasn't come up, and you're seeking guidance from FERC on how to do something. But my understanding, FERC already has some guidance on cost allocation. So that's why I'm struggling with this one, because I think there are some decisions out there that cover cost allocation. And so if you submit a filing that doesn't put forth some details, I just don't know how that's going to be received by FERC.
So I'm just thinking off the top of my head at the moment. I mean, going back to the point that David and Tony made a while ago, seemed to point to maybe we need to figure out the backstop provision sooner rather than later, and the backstop provisions become specific enough to So I don't know. Maybe that goes to what you're asking.
I mean, obviously the backdrop has to be the just and reasonable criteria, but then that would not prevent this body of state regulators coming up with something else on a particular criteria.
That they all agreed
with. Could FERC could consider, okay, that's just and reasonable.
Yes.
And that the two could exist in parallel, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, that may be you.
Without having the backstop, then you're giving. So if I was I'm trying to put myself in a decision maker. I can't make a decision because I don't have enough detail.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's just and reasonable.
Yeah. Okay. I see your point.
All right.
But I think maybe addressing this backstop provision sooner might resolve what you're bringing up, right?
Yeah, because you want to get this done by the end of the year, and I just seems to be especially if you have the language here, we'll defer it to a body state regulator. I could just see the FERC saying deficiency.
Yeah.
You know, add more detail.
Right.
Because we can't conclude that. I mean, well, first they're going to say no. We decide the ultimate, details is going to be under FERC decision. But there's nothing in here to give us a tariff that it would be just and reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Lorenzo Eric Menzel, PG&E again. Regarding your single regional wheeling rate and your development of it, it sounds like it's similar to the current rate, which is a weighted average. You know, TAC is a weighted average of the revenue requirements, if I can describe it that way. Wheeling is connected both on interties, and it's collected on internally, so Santa Clara or DWR, when they wheel off the system, they pay wheeling.
Yeah.
They pay both low and possibly high, low and high voltage wheeling, so
right.
Depending on what at what point they do it. And today, wheeling revenue, which is not part of the TAC, TAC development process, it's a credit that goes to customers. The wheeling revenue is allocated to the ownership of the interconnection point directly. So if a PTO owns the interconnection 100%, the wheeling revenue goes to them 100%. Doesn't matter if it's an intertie or if it's internally. And if there's some percentage ownership, I believe it's the wheeling revenue is divided up based on that percentage.
But, okay.
I'm not that familiar with that part. My question to you is the process that you're proposing, both the rate development is very similar,
mm-hmm.
but the allocation process you just talked about is very, very different. And can you please justify the difference and why it makes sense? And I'm also a little bit curious how you would deal with projects or interties where there is a cost recovery that's split between subregions, because then again, that doesn't directly address ownership, that that intertie might be owned by one entity, but the cost recovery, there might be multiple subregions that pay for that intertie in some manner. But again, I'm curious about the revenue and how it's going to be allocated, because again, right now it's just straight what you propose is a weighted average based on load, and it seems very different from what's done today, and I'm looking for some justification why that makes sense to the ISO.
Okay. Thank you. You've given us a homework assignment. So, I mean, it's something that we're going to have to think through in working out more of the details of this proposal. And frankly, we don't have them at this point. So, okay. I mean, you bring... Well, some of what you just told me about issues that you're concerned about are very useful comments, because we have to go the next step and turn this into some formulaic basis that deals with all of those cases. So, I apologize that we're kind of giving you homework, but we have to do the homework of the next step of taking this from a conceptual idea that we've got here and spelling it out in more detail in terms of formulas, in terms of the special cases that you raised and all that. It's not there yet.
While you're on this, Denise Parrish, Wyoming OCA, while you're on this slide, I have one additional process question where you're talking about things to be addressed in the next options paper. I know that the schedule showed that there would be another stakeholder meeting once you issue the next paper, but is there also another round of comments?
There is on this.
And that's what I wondered, because I thought that you were just going to issue the proposal, have a stakeholder meeting, and then take it to the board. So I didn't understand that there would be yet another round of comments.
After
issuing whatever
after
you're going to issue,
yes, there would be.
There'll be another round of comments.
Yes, there would be. We just
okay.
haven't spelled out the dates yet. It would be sometime in July.
Okay.
Okay. Yes.
Operator, we'll go ahead and take the question in the queue.
This is Shelly Ann May from TransCanyon. Going back to the issue of the role of state regulators in the decision to build and in cost allocation, can we look to what is being done in other multi-state ISOs, for instance, MISO or ISO New England, in terms of fleshing out the detail of what that interaction between state regulators and the expanded ISO's transmission planning process would look like?
So there's two parts, I think, that you're asking about, maybe not both, but I heard the relationship between the planning process and the body of state regulators, and two, are you talking about how the body of state regulators makes decisions as well, or are you just asking the first part?
Well, your proposal says that the state regulators would be involved in the decision to build and in cost allocation, so maybe this is, you need to educate me a little bit more about how your proposal would work, but I would think that if the state regulators are involved in those decisions, they would have to interact and interface in the expanded TPP process. So my question is, as we look to sort of put the details together of how that would work, are there models that we can look at in other markets that would help us to flesh out those details?
Yeah, we can find out more about that. What I understand is that in the case of both New England and MISO, that the planning engineering process of the ISO did provide input in the form of studies and recommendations regarding the needs to be met and the preferred or recommended solutions to meet those needs, which became information that the state regulatory body used to reach agreement on what things to build and how to share the cost. We can try to find out some more information about that, though.
Okay, thank you.
Kim, are there any other questions? Thank you.
Not at this time. Oh, we just received one more caller.
Sorry, Kim, I couldn't hear you.
We just received another caller in the queue.
Oh, we did. Okay, another question.
This is Liam Nye from Xcel Energy. I think there are a couple of single state RTOs that have the that might have kind of the states provide that recommendation of the actual projects and cost allocation, or maybe more just the projects. But I believe that for the places like SDP or the Mid-Continent ISO, they the state regulators are they're involved or were involved and have been involved and are involved in kind of developing the cost allocation process and what ultimately results in a tariff filing and kind of a description of how costs are allocated. But I don't think that they have the authority to pick and choose which projects do get built or have the authority to determine specific cost allocation for specific projects, every year that might be different from the previous years or from other projects in the plan. So I think that those parts, it might be more difficult to do something like that. I think it might be kind of a long road if you're expecting the state body to make a consensus decision on each specific project and how it gets cost allocated if it's going to change year to year.
Yeah, that's a good point. What we've gathered from the other RTOs is really, I guess, two different basic models. In the case of SPP, the state bodies basically agreed on a set of cost allocation rules that got embodied in this pretty much formulaic approach of SPP, what they call the highway-byway system, which allocates cost basically on a formulaic basis based on the category of the facility. And so the role of the states there was coming to agreement on this methodology, beyond which there were no further decisions required because, they had set up the methodology that would be applied going forward. In the case of MISO and New England, my understanding is that the state groups got together to decide on a specific package of upgrades, kind of as a one-time event in which they identified a number of upgrades that would benefit the entire system and how to allocate the costs of that package of upgrades. It was not a sequential, let's look at one thing at a time and then get together next year and look at another one. You're bringing up a good point. I think these other models definitely warrant some examination because we do need to have from year to year, and Well, I'll leave it at that. Those are the models that I'm aware of, and we'll get some more details on that. Last slide. These are some provisions. These are two things that that are principles or ideas that were left over from the last proposal that, you know, as we rethink where we're going with this, we think they still make sense, but realize that as this body of state regulators concept unfolds and gets developed in more detail, it's hard to say that these absolutely should be included in an ISO proposal, because it may be that the state board would decide something different. Now, going back to the conversation we had a few minutes ago about the ISO backstop rule, maybe these things appear as part of our backstop package of rules. This is what we're going to do, with always the proviso that the state body could come up with its own recipe for cost allocation for the facilities that. But anyway, these are pretty familiar to what we had before. The first one being that a subsequent PTO that joins the expanded BAA at a later date may still be allocated a cost share for a new regional facility that was approved previously. And we went through rationale for why that's important to not create incentives for an entity that could benefit. When you think about how integrated the West is potentially, if more people join, then incentive to stay out, let these other entities decide, that be cost, but they get a lot of benefits. So the idea being a new PTO joins, and now there's this regional facility that's being prepared, well, let's do some kind of a assessment under whatever our backstop methodology is, and see whether this new entity gets a share of, warranted getting a share of the costs. Similarly, the second bullet was this idea of recalculation. How often should we recalculate benefits? We had that idea in the earlier proposal, but it was basically an annual thing at that time, which we agree was often. But if a new PTO joins and creates a new subregion, then I think we do need to calculate what those benefits would be, or perhaps every 5 years if there's other transmission upgrades going in, maybe not a new subregion, but enough transmission upgrades that the flows change, that some sense of the benefit. So what we are left with is these two principles that I think would form part of what is an ISO backstop proposal for cost allocation. So the one modification being that on the second bullet, instead of doing it every year, we're saying only when there's a new PTO that creates a new subregion, or not more than once every 5 years. Yeah, go ahead.
Tim, we'll take the question on the phone.
Hi, this is Lee Terry from State Water Project. I'm just a little confused on that very, I see what you wrote on your bullet item as a minimum frequency of not less than every 5 years, but in your write-up on your straw proposal, and on page 8, item 9, I see it saying at least once every 5 years. I see that saying that it wouldn't be going any longer than 5 years, if not shorter, so I'm just wanting some clarification on what you meant there.
Oh, okay, sorry for that confusion. Yes, what we meant is don't go any longer than 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, you're right, that wasn't clear. Sorry for that.
Any questions in the room? Anybody has a question on the phone, they can enter the queue by pressing pound 2.
Yes, Lauren Rosenblatt from NV Energy. Forgive me if I missed it, but I do want to be clear. If there's a regional project that gets regional cost allocation, based on the Order 1000 principles of costs and benefits, and a new PTO joins, and the new project doesn't offer any benefits to the joining PTO, would the joining PTO still receive some cost allocation? Or no? Is there an opportunity to demonstrate no benefits?
I think our sense at this point is that there would have to be a demonstration of benefits and that a cost allocation would be commensurate with the share.
Okay, thanks. Okay, Tim, I see someone's entered the queue. We'll go ahead and take the question.
This is Shallyann May from TransCanyon. I have a question on the bullet here that has to do with the recalculation of sub-regional cost-benefit shares. And my question is whether that could have the effect of calling into question or resulting in the re-evaluation of a project that was previously deemed to be beneficial. In other words, a project has been approved and as a result of this recalculation of the sub-regional cost benefit shares, is there a risk that questions would be opened up about whether that project is still beneficial?
I don't think so. I mean, we don't go back and reevaluate projects that are already part of the grid. You know, you may upgrade something later that may change the benefits of a thing of something you built earlier, but we don't try to do that after the fact assessment. So I don't think that would happen.
So I'm not talking about a project that has been fully built, if you will. I'm talking about a project that has been approved but hasn't been placed in service. And you do this recalculation, and I'm just wondering whether that raises the risk of that project being reconsidered.
I don't think so. I mean, no, I can't see how that would happen. That could happen today. You could imagine the same thing happening today. We do subsequent studies for things that were approved last year or 2 years ago that are not in service yet. Sometimes they don't go through because they fail at the siting or environmental review, but in terms of evaluation of need and cost benefit, you know, we don't go back and undo that evaluation.
Okay, thank you.
Well, this is Jan from San Diego. Actually, want to follow up on that comment because I do think you create the possibility of some awkward outcomes. A project that when it was approved, looked, you know, marginally beneficial. A new PTO joins. We redo the analysis, and as we know, these analyses are really rough. We find out, it doesn't look so good now. And I think it raises some potential just and reasonableness issues, which, frankly, I'd rather not have to confront. Mm-hmm. I understand the, you know, where you're trying to go with this proposal, but I still think you should seriously consider the alternative of locking down the allocations at the time of approval. And then when a new PTO comes in, then any new projects from that point on, that new PTO might end up sharing based on benefits. But it's not, you know, subject to getting a piece of things for decisions that were made prior to that entity joining. Because remember, prior to the new PTO joining, FERC's decided that this project's beneficial for that subset of customers without that PTO. So we already have a determination that the project's beneficial.
Right.
So while I understand there's some advantages in the fairness and all that to reallocate every time a PTO joins, I think it's going to introduce some awkwardness. I think it makes it much more complicated. I think you should seriously consider the simpler approach of just locking things down as PTOs join.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm David Cohen, Navigant. I just wanted to point out that the ISO does reevaluate projects. Coolwater Lugo has been decided not needed, which because Southern California Edison had FERC incentive rate making for abandoned cost recovery, they're protected on the amount of money they spend. So the ISO does have, over several examples, determined that a project that it prior approved and was needed is no longer needed. So, you know, you have done that, and Coolwater Lugo is the most recent example.
Lorenzo, Eric Mendel again, PG&E. Quick question. I always thought that the regional rate was going to be a license plate rate. Is that correct?
Well, regional by definition would be
everybody would pay the same
system-wide component, which would be postage stamp.
Sorry, postage stamp.
Okay.
My mistake there. So I was trying to work through the example you have PTO 1, the ISO existing, you have PTO 2, Pacific Core joining, and you do a cost allocation on maybe various projects, and they get a percentage assigned to each one. When you have PTO, I think you actually call them PTO number 2 joining, so a third one, or the one after Pacific Core, and if it's found that they have no benefit from the new projects, what regional rate do they pay?
Well, they would have the sub-regional rate for their own existing facilities, and I guess they would not have a share of that regional body of revenue requirements.
Okay, so then assign them a different percentage share. I'm trying to figure out if you're going to end up with multiple regional rates rather than a postage stamp rate.
Well, if the benefits align with load ratio shares, then the postage stamp rate.
But
does the
you don't know that you've punted the benefits test into a different form, so we don't have any clarity on that at all.
Right.
But you're still advertising or thinking is going to be a postage stamp regional rate, and I'm not sure if we can say that.
Right. You're right. But I think to be more precise, if we're doing a benefits assessment, then the benefits assessment would give us adders to the sub-regional rate that would be specific. Right, I think that's where you're going.
Yeah.
I think that's a more precise way to say it. Yeah.
Hi, Dave Smith with Transwest Express again, and I know I keep bringing up the same point over and over again, but also here in this case, the other entities that may or may not join the expanded RTO. We'll also have an opportunity to participate in the interregional transmission planning process, and we'll probably have already taken a chance at if they want to participate in a project or if they think there's benefits. So I think just like your expanded ISO, there's a lot of information and cost allocation thinking that can and should be done even in advance of these projects coming on board. Because, again, transmission planning takes a long time. Transmission development takes a long time. Formation of an ISO and expansion of an ISO takes a long time. These can all be done in parallel, and I think that would help ease, you know, these questions because there'd be a lot of thought and process made in the interregional process. You know, if NB Energy wants to join at some point, they're in West Connect now. That's one of the regions that is doing the interregional planning process. So I think if you keep that in mind when you're doing all this, it'll make I don't know. I think it makes it easier, but it might make it just so much more complicated for you guys as you're thinking about this.
Well, it sounds like you're suggesting that with, you know, this interregional planning coordination activity and getting all the entities involved, that the second bullet here is maybe unnecessary, right?
Well, it still might be necessary, but it might be predetermined through that other process.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm not trying to change how costs get allocated. I'm when and how, under what process can they be done? It can be done whether the ISO expands or doesn't expand.
Okay. Thanks.
You know, in accordance with your present tariff, right? I mean, today.
Yeah, yeah. Then, for those who've been patient.
Next steps for this initiative, we are taking written comments for the revised draft proposal. You can submit those to the initiative comments by close of business on June 10th. And any upcoming meetings will be announced through marketing.
Yes, we will. We'll get one out tomorrow morning. Okay, yeah, we'll do that. And again, I just want, pardon me? Okay. I just want to emphasize, I realize that a lot in this proposal is not completely spelled out, not completely thought out, and so a lot of the comments that folks have made today really point at next steps that need to happen in making this more complete and more detailed. So I appreciate that. I appreciate your patience, and think of more issues that we have left unresolved here. Point them out in the comments as ways to kind of take this to the next step, because that's where we are at this moment. Okay, thanks.
And for those on the phone, we are going to be publishing a comments template on the initiative webpage. So fairly soon, within a day. So, also thank you to the collective agency for hosting the facility. They transformed it overnight. Didn't look anything like this yesterday, so appreciate it very much. We may see some of you back for the regional resource adequacy meeting tomorrow.
Folks were asking about places to eat. The Pearl District is about 0.3 miles away from here to, I don't know, that direction. So just look on your Google Maps and there's a bunch of restaurants over there.
Did you say 43 miles?
0.3 miles.
A third of a mile. Thanks, Tim, for your help. Appreciate it.